Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. This is Mona Montgomery with this evening's edition of the Hula Hoax. Did you know there were no gas chambers in Germany or anywhere else under Hitler? Did you know that there were no Jew skin lampshades made and that there was no pure Jew fat soap? Maybe you do and maybe you don't. A lot of people don't know that because there are laws in 9 European countries that make you go to jail for saying what I just said. So there's really no open inquiry into this event known as the Holocaust, which I call the Hula Hoax, because it's all a pack of communist propaganda aimed at destroying the great white race, just exactly as Ahmed Ahmadinejad Jab said. And he's got it right. We are being targeted for extermination by the Jews who have successfully hornswoggled all of our people, including, of course, our children, into believing that under our beautiful, white, blonde, blue-eyed, and variations thereof, brown eyes, brown hair, beautiful faces, kind dispositions, and high intelligence, there lurks an evil devil capable of doing things that we're totally incapable of doing. And it's to our shame that we ever believed these stories even for a second, because they discredit our own racial kinsmen. But who has not been taken in by these lies? They are so compelling, and the guilt that's foisted on us is so great. Today, I've been spending a whole week taking care of my brother, letting him stay here while he does his business deals. And of course, it's fun to entertain my brother because he's a very entertaining, very handsome white man. Age 68. He's always been a charmer, and I like having him here, but it's a very exhausting to have a house guest. You have to watch your valuables and make sure they don't find them and maybe decide to run off with them and shoot you, and then they get the family inheritance as well. I mean, it really is hard. Taking house guests into your home is a very sensitive issue, and I understand why there are so many rules of etiquette surrounding it. Because you really can't leave your guests alone. You just never know what they're going to do. But my brother is a real interesting character. He's a genius, of course, as are many of you out there with your pure white lineage. And he, as I said, is 68, and he's made some money. And so he's decided that he cannot go through life any longer without a female muse. A lady who will inspire him and make him work on what he most wants to work on, which is proselytizing his weird brand of Christianity, known as the Urantia Society. And I'll get into that later. But what's more interesting to me, I think, is that the market out there needs to be revealed. We need to know that men of 65 and older are in hog heaven when it comes to the dating world. There are about 40 women to every one man because they've all died off. The women have been taking care of themselves. They've been dieting, exercising, educating themselves, hoping that they will one day qualify for Prince Charming. This, of course, is part of the women's liberation myth that fooled us all in the 60s. That we could do better if we devoted ourselves to ourselves instead of to our families. So what we have now is a whole lot of women between 55 and 65 or even 70 who look like models, who they're all blonde. They all know how to, they all get themselves coiffed with the highlights, and they've all got beautiful skin because if they didn't have it naturally, they've had it taken care of. They're all slim because they're dieting and exercising. And they're all looking for Prince Charming. Most of our Prince Charmings have died from overwork. And so, as I said, the ratio is 40 to 1. 40 women to every one man. And my brother is enjoying every minute of it. He came here because his girlfriend of 9 years kicked him out. She couldn't stand having him tippity-tappity-ing away on the computer every waking minute of his life pursuing his muse because she wasn't good enough for him. So he asked if he could stay with me while he was in town, and I said yes. And in fact, the girl was telling the truth. This man has spent every waking minute of his life sitting at my computer, tippity-tappity-tapping away on the keys, have to practically yell at him to get his attention for anything, because he's never had so much fun in his life. He gets emails from these girls, he emails them back, he might spend an hour working out an email, and then he sends it, and then he gets one from another girl, and then he gets a telephone call, and he spends, in one case, he spent 3 hours talking to the girl on the telephone, and when they were finally exhausted, and he was thinking, well, maybe we've talked enough on the phone, he gets a message, doing, 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 which says, you got an email. He hangs up the phone, goes over to the computer, and starts working on the next one. And it's just so funny, and it's something that everybody needs to know, because, girls, be careful. If you think that Prince Charming is going to be there when you're 60, you might have to fight off 40 other women, 20 of whom will be model quality. So he's got, I'm going to talk about four of his girls, and I'm going to call them A, B, C, D, and Betty, Kathy, and Diane. To give you an idea of what's going on in the geezer world, the world of geezer sex. Now, Anne, and she's not the only one, is an expert at Tantra yoga. Now, I don't know why anybody would want to do Tantra yoga if they're looking for good sex, because if you want good sex, you have to get married. I hate to break it to you, but I honestly don't believe it's possible to master the art of casual sex, at least not for a woman. And the Bible makes it very clear that when a man and a woman get married, the man is supposed to take a year out of his life, not do any important business, and not go to war, so that he can bring joy to his wife. Well, I've been married, and it took about a year before my husband was bringing joy to me. So I think the Bible's probably correct on that one. But these girls are just stretching every boundary that they can manage to break to master their need for good sex, which they could have got if they'd gotten married, but they didn't. They've just been doing self-improvement courses for the last 40 years. So this is what they've come up with. The ladies have come up with Tantra sex. It's a form of yoga in which the man never achieves orgasm. Well, I can see a little logic behind that. It is true that women don't achieve orgasm as quickly as men, but just as the Bible tells us, that works itself out in about a year. But these guys don't want to waste a year. They've got to have it now. So the women are coming across like saints. They're responding to my brother's ad. He's looking for a spiritual woman who will be his muse. And they say, I am a saint. I am a saint. I am spiritual. I can teach you Tantra yoga. And he thinks it's very interesting. And I said, chick, that's just a complicated way of saying, hold off, Buster. But chick's falling for it, hook, line, and sinker. Now, Betty is an Anglican priest, and she looks like a movie star. She's tall, she's slender, she's blue-eyed, long blonde hair, and she could qualify for the finest life that anyone could have on this earth, but she has decided to be an Episcopalian priest. So she may not have time, she tells my brother, for the kind of relation he envisions, because she's busy with her own mission, which is, of course, to feed Negroes. And, by the way, she is an astrologer, and she wanted to know his sign, and she's doing his chart. So here we have, in the Anglican Church, which is the church I was brought up in, which is supposed to be the absolute ultimate in moral values and conservative moral values, including encouraging women to have education. The Episcopalian Church is the most intellectual of the Christian churches and also the most wealthy. At least it was in the past. I don't know what's going on with the Christian church today. But they would never have dreamed of having a woman priest, and I can't imagine anyone wanting to take the sacrament from a female priest. Our priests wear black robes like the Catholics, and it's just very much of a male-dominated religion. But today, thanks to the work the homosexuals have done, we now have not only homosexual priests, but female priests. And this one practices astrology on the side. So that was a revelation that I'm glad my brother was able to convey to me. I never would have dreamed such a thing was happening. Going on to girl C, we'll call her Kathy. She is a Bible-believing Christian. She says that every word in the Bible is accurate, including the sun standing still for 4 hours during an important battle, and that if you don't believe one part of the Bible, you shouldn't believe any part of the Bible. So this didn't get very far, even though she's a multimillionaire, because he tried to explain to her, why can't you love God and love Jesus and read the Bible and love the Bible without taking it literally, which is what Episcopalians have always been taught. But no, she says, if one phrase fails, it all fails. And this is the attitude of the fundamentalists. Now, Diane D, Earl D, is also an expert in Tantra yoga and met my brother with an aphrodisiac in her hand. And she has entertained him for many hours by a book that she's writing, which is about the Federal Reserve. And she has come up with something that's very, very important. She says, and she's totally right, she proves it, that all we have to do to save ourselves financially is to stop relations with the Federal Reserve. Why, she says, are we paying interest to the Federal Reserve, which is owned by the private families, most of them Jewish, you've heard of them, the Kahn family, Loeb is one of the names that comes to mind, of course the Rothschilds. These are just rich Jews who own the Federal Reserve Bank. There's nothing federal about it. But while most of us are aware of that, I have never heard anyone come up with a solution, which is so simple, you just won't believe it. All we have to do is claim our right as a government to print our own money and not charge ourselves interest. And there goes the $50 trillion debt that we've racked up for these Jews. Now, I have another way around that debt. I think we should sue these Jews for the lies they told about the gas chambers and the $50 trillion that they've gotten from the white race, based on these communist propaganda, this total fraud, treble the damages, and we can get $150 trillion from them that way, which seems to me one way to go. But that's probably farther down the road. In the meantime, she's absolutely right. Why are we paying Jews to print out money at interest? We can do it ourselves. And it's been done in the past many times. During the colonies, before we even were a country, we were printing our own money, and it was because King George told us we couldn't do it anymore. That was one of the root causes of the Revolutionary War. But it really works very well. Somebody decides how much money needs to be floating around so that everyone can exchange it for business and services, and that's what you use for money, and that way you can exchange your goods and your services. No need to pay interest on it. But somehow, since the Rothschilds took over Europe about 400 years ago, the white race has been paying interest to the Jews for absolutely no good reason. And any time anybody stands up and says, this is silly, I'll do my own printing of money, they get destroyed, like Adolf Hitler. It was Adolf Hitler who refused to go along with the program, and you saw what happened to him and how horribly he's been maligned. Anyone who stands up to the Jews and says, we can do our own printing, pays a horrible price. But we need to do that, because there's absolutely no reason why we should be paying interest on the money that we ourselves can print. Now, I admit I don't have it completely solidly figured out, but probably some of you do. As it stands now, as soon as the budget is used up and Congress is talked into a new project like building a dam, let's say, and that project is going to cost $100 billion. Well, that's too much for a dam. It's going to cost $10 billion. The government goes down to the Federal Reserve and says, we need $10 billion in currency. And the Federal Reserve prints out $10 billion in currency and has our government sign a note promising that the taxpayers will pay it back with interest. See? That's just ridiculous, isn't it? They don't have any money. They just print it. If you want to know what the Federal Reserve is, it's like a great big building with a printing press inside. And she explains, this girl that my brother's dating, she explains how it started out, which is kind of interesting. In the very beginning of civilization, people traded in precious, well, they traded in berries and wheat and labor, but that became very hard to unwieldy. It was an unwieldy situation, so everybody started using the same thing, let's say berries, because they're small and easy to carry around. So we developed a medium of exchange. That changed to gold and silver, because gold and silver are very small and easy to deal with. You can make coins and you can stamp whatever you want to on it, and then you have a medium of exchange. So the goldsmith became important, because he was the one who could punch out the gold coins, and then you could take your gold coin and trade it with your neighbor for goods and services. But then people figured out that it was better to have the goldsmith hold on to their gold than for them to try to keep it in their house and protect it with guns. So they went to the goldsmith and they said, here's my gold, you put it in your safe, which is much stronger and bigger than mine. And the goldsmith would do that, probably charged a little fee for protecting the guy's gold. But what the goldsmith figured out after not too long was that people didn't come in every day and ask to have their gold back. They came in about 10% of the time every year. So only 10% of the gold was leaving the goldsmith's bank vault. So then the goldsmith started doing something which is evil. The goldsmith started printing currency, which said, I have $10 worth of Mr. Jones's gold, which I will give to the bearer of this note. And when people came in with the notes, the goldsmith would give him the gold, but the goldsmith noticed that only 10% of the people were coming in every year, so the goldsmith started issuing more banknotes. In fact, he could issue maybe 9 times the number of banknotes, and it wouldn't bother anybody, because people were only coming in 10% of the time. And this is what began the practice of usury, which the Bible condemns. So what we had now was a goldsmith turning into a banker, and that's what the Federal Reserve is. It's the Jews who used to print out gold who are now printing out currency with nothing to back the currency. Now, it might be okay to have fractional reserve banking, which is what I just described, if they weren't charging interest on it. But they are. And according to fractional reserve banking is a mistake. There should be 100% reserve banking. In other words, no notes should be out that aren't accounted for with proper accounting policies, so that if everyone did come in at the same time and wanted to get their currency exchanged for a reasonable medium, they could do it. But the other thing is, there's no reason for us to be paying to the Jews interest on our own money, which our government should be printing. And I think this is a fascinating idea, and I was so very happy to meet this woman, and then to watch my brother's reaction. Of course, he doesn't care at all about 9/11 truth or Federal Reserve. He's just a happy man, spending his whole day talking to beautiful women. But he was asked by her to do the book cover, and since he is a very gifted artist, he was able to do a beautiful book cover with her, which was the creative work that came out of this relationship. But, let's see, where was I going to go with that? I was going to tell you that this dating thing is causing a lot of creativity that might actually be something we need to look into. So far, there hasn't been any sex between my brother and these girls, because they're all very serious and they want to make sure that they're getting into a relationship that will last. So there's nothing really evil happening at all. If I made it to sound evil, what I was really trying to do is say, it's going to be hard on the women when they find out the reality of the statistics. But no wrongdoing is going on. They're just meeting each other and exchanging ideas. And because my brother is looking for a muse, all of the women are offering him their most creative ideas. And then he'll go to another girl, and he's still, like, for instance, he was working on, I called her Diane D. He was working on Diane's book cover, and then the next night he had a date with an art teacher. So then he went to the art teacher, and he took the work he was doing for the writer, and the art teacher made some wonderful corrections, told him to change the color of the background and to emphasize some of the elements in the picture, and made it much, much better. And they all know about each other, and they're all happy to be involved in this lifestyle that I find amazing. Don't forget the pledge drive that we're involved in trying to get Hal some money. You can mail your checks to Hal Turner, 1906 Patterson Plank Road, North Bergen, New Jersey, 07047. And I hope that everybody is as gratified as I am at the response that we've gotten the last month, ever since that guy from Reykjavik, Iceland, offered to match $4,000. We are actually over the top now. Don't get me wrong, we can't go backwards, but we're at the point where we see that we do have power if we're willing to participate, each one of us. Some of the contributions were only $5 or $10. In fact, one guy took the time to write out a check for $2, and I think that's fine. I think that's great. But we can't stop now. As it stands, the Hal Turner Network is drawing more attention than the next competitor, who I think is not going to be as likely to succeed as Hal will, and I'll tell you why. Hal Turner does a one-man show. It costs a lot of money in technology, but he and he alone controls all of the elements. So if anything gets out of control, Hal has to fix it, and then he has learned what he needs to know in order to keep the show going. And if you notice all of the other shows, you'll find that they're all getting drop-offs. Because even though they're not telling the truth about the white race, which is essential to your understanding of how we've been cheated, they leave that out. Even so, they're threatening enough to the Jewish establishment that they're getting all of these DOS attacks. And you can't hardly listen to the program because you're getting kicked off of the server all the time. Well, Hal went through that about a year and a half ago. And he has the solution. He has the Hal Turner solution. And he's got his server within range where he can actually go visit them when they start playing shenanigans on him, as he did once. And he actually found that somebody had mechanically messed up the server, and he looked at it, took the cover off of the computer, and saw it, fixed it. And I don't think there have been any problems since. But the point is, when you're doing a one-man show like Hal is, you're in complete control of all of these things that can happen, and each time you master a new problem, you go forward and you have that tool in your bag of tools. So thanks to the contributions that we've all made, Hal is, I believe, I'm guessing, because I've talked to Hal about it, but I am guessing that he's starting to slightly relax, and that's what we need. We need our executives to be relaxed and confident so that they can handle the problems they have instead of getting a heart attack and dying, which can happen when you're under too much pressure. But we have to do our part, and our part is to support the show, to take money out of our pockets and send it to Hal, or sign up for a show like the show I'm doing now in order to get your voice out, and you pay for that. You work that contract out with Hal, and that's how you pay. If you're too shy or you don't think your voice is ready, you just pay money. But everybody has to stand up and hopefully intend one day to get on the microphone, or at least support those who do. And that's the only way we're going to get our voice heard. So again, I'm extremely gratified that everybody chipped in, and I again advise you to get your envelope out and write it down, and I'll give you the address. Get a stamp out and put your money in, and let's keep this thing going so that we can go up instead of going back. We don't want to keep going forward one step and going back two steps. We want to start going forward steadily. So again, the address is Hal Turner, 1906 Patterson Plank Road, North Bergen, New Jersey, 07047. Now, my brother, the racist, who is a beautiful, blue-eyed blonde man, in good health, probably to be over 100, does not believe that whites should live separately. His religion teaches him that it's God's plan that we should all be one tan race. And yet he believes in evolution, and he's drawn a beautiful picture that shows the man and the woman standing on the planet Earth looking at the rest of the universe and God's beautiful, glorious universe, having evolved from all of these ape men and turning into beautiful white men in the dark. But you can't see that evolution will go backwards if we don't stay separate. And this is what the Jew understands. See, the Jew doesn't care about what happens to future generations. He just cares about himself because he's not white. So being not white, he doesn't embrace the ethics of the white man, which are to master his own nature, the evil side of his nature, in order to make himself a better person, as we do. Like the women dieting, or the men giving up drinking, or learning to be polite to each other, even if you're angry. All of the Christian principles that we work so hard to emulate so that we can have mastery over ourselves is essential to the white race. The other races see their mission as fighting the other races. And that's the difference between white people and non-white people. So, if we do not appreciate our own welfare, our own identity, enough to recognize that we are so superior to the other races, that any change in terms of mongrelization is going to take us backwards or even sideways. And that's what we do not want to do. So I tried to explain this to him yesterday. I said, you know, because my brother is a very spiritual man. He really loves Jesus Christ. And he really loves God. And he really loves the universe. He just got involved in a bad religion, I'm afraid. But when I told him this, when I said the white race is the only race that has the potential for evolving into the next step. And we have to take responsibility for keeping our genes pure in order to make that step, to make us closer to God than we are today. And he said he didn't believe that was crazy Nazi talk, and it's very upsetting to him to hear it. And I said, well, Chick, I can prove to you in the Bible that Jesus believed this. And being my older brother, he called me names and said I was a liar again. So I went and got the Bible, and I took him to Matthew 15:24, which is the story of the non-white lady who asked for Christ's blessing. And then he says, I can't bless you because I'm busy with my own people. I'm here taking care of the children, the lost children of Israel, and I don't want anything to do with you. You're not of this race. And then she said, but I recognize that, Jesus. I recognize that I'm not a member of the superior race. But even the dogs under the table get crumbs that are left by their masters. And that's when Jesus blessed her and gave her what she wanted. And I'd like to read it to you because I know there are people who don't know the Bible who simply won't believe it. So Jesus went to thence and departed into the coast of Tyre and Sidon. And behold, a woman of Canaan came out of the same coast and cried unto him, saying, have mercy on me, O Lord, thou son of David. My daughter is grievously vexed with the devil. Now, this woman was a Canaanite. See, behold, a woman of Canaan came out of the same coast and talked to Jesus. She was a Canaanite. The Canaanites are the Edomites, are the people who are crucifying Christ to this day. They are the Jews who claim to be Jews and are not Jews. They are darker. They have ugly faces. They aren't anything like the beautiful white race of God. So she said, have mercy on me, O Lord, thou son of David, recognizing that Jesus was of the white lineage of the house of David. who, by the way, if you don't know this, was David was described in the Bible as being fair of countenance, which tells us that he's a white man. And she says, my daughter is grievously vexed with the devil. So she's asking Jesus to come and save her daughter who's grievously vexed with the devil. And of course, anyone who knows what the black race is like, or the brown race, or the mixed races, you know that most of them are vexed with the devil. But here was a mother who was considerate enough of her daughter to go to the master and ask for help. But he, and now I'm quoting the Bible again, but he answered her not a word. And his disciples came and besought him, saying, send her away, for she crieth after us. See, he wouldn't talk to her. He just, you know what white men are like when they're insulted. They just keep walking forward without a word, and just maybe a look of disdain on their face. But the apostles wanted him to tell her to go away because she just wouldn't leave them alone, in spite of the fact that he was clearly snubbing her. Verse 24, but he answered and said, I am not sent, but unto the lost children of the house of Israel. And I'll repeat that, because that's the pivotal phrase. He answered and said, I am not sent, but unto the lost sheep of the house of Israel. Now, you know that the lost sheep of the house of Israel is us. We are the ones who fled to all parts of the world during the Babylonian captivity and the Syrian captivity, in order to avoid being mongrelized. But a lot of people did go into captivity and did get mongrelized and got confusion of faith. And when they came back, Jesus, whose family had not been in captivity and who still spoke Greek and still bore the physical characteristics of a Greek statue, realized that he had to rehabilitate this race. So he saw that his mission was unto the lost sheep of the house of Israel, which is what he says to this lady here. He says, I am not sent but unto the lost sheep of the house of Israel. In other words, the white people. Verse 25. Then came she and worshipped him, saying, Lord, help me. But he answered and said, it is not meet to take the children's bread and to cast it to dogs. He did not want to waste any of his precious energy on any but the lost sheep of the house of Israel. In fact, he would feel that he was depriving his real followers, the ones that God sent him to care for, by curing anyone else. And that's what he told her. And she said, truth, Lord, yet the dogs eat of the crumbs which fall from their master's table. Then Jesus answered and said unto her, O woman, great is thy faith. Be it unto thee even as thou wilt. And her daughter was made whole from that very hour. And I think this teaches us our proper relationship to the Edomites and the Canaanites. That if they will understand, as this woman did, that we are the master race, and that Jesus came to repair our race and return us to rule the world in dignity and kindness, I don't think we need to cut these people off. But if they don't fall down as this woman did and admit that, let's see how she put it. She said, yet even the dogs eat of the crumbs which fall from their master's table, and he was so impressed with her that he healed the daughter. So they said, they submitted. The non-white woman submitted and said, I'm only asking for the crumbs from your table. I'm not asking for you to make me one of the house of Israel. I'm just saying that give me what falls from your table and I'll be so happy. And really, I really think this is how the non-whites are going to have to look at us, and how they have looked at us for thousands of years until only recently, when communist propaganda emerged and started programming people through massive control of the media to believe that we are the evil race, and that our beauty and our intelligence and our charm hides the hideous devil that could create gas chambers and Jew soap, pure Jew pet soap, and Jew skin lampshades, all of which has been disproven. So here we see the proper way to relate to Jesus Christ if you're a non-white, which is with worship and gratitude. How many non-whites do you know that have any gratitude for what we've done for them. I know very, very few. In fact, I don't think I've ever heard a Negro or a Jew or anybody say, I'm grateful to the white race for the castles and museums and churches that they've built, and I'm so happy to be able to share in the white man's civilization. That's not what you hear. So until we hear that, we should snub these people as Jesus did. And that's the biblical lesson for the day. That's Matthew 14, and it starts at 21. So what is in the news today? Well, we're starting candidates are starting to file their paperwork for city council, and I was seriously considering running for city council, because if you run for city council, you get to go to parties all the time, and they pay for them, and you get to get up and say one or two things at each party, and I thought it would be fun to go to all these parties and get up and say, hi, I'm Mona, and I'm a white racist, and I think that the view of the majority white race should be taken into consideration here at the city council instead of being silenced. And I was just kind of wondering if that would be a good idea or not. I certainly wouldn't want to do it any other way, but I think I'm a little old for that, because you take a lot of heat. We have E. coli bacteria in the harvest area here in California, which means that fecal matter is getting into our farm produce, including spinach, which has been taken off the shelf. Now, this is not the first time this has happened to us, and I frankly think that the Mexicans are involved. Even the Mexicans think the Mexicans are involved. I went to the grocery store to get some canned spinach. I have a whole shelf of canned spinach, enough to last me for 6 months, which I think you ought to do too. Get yourself some canned goods, because you need at least 3 months' supply in case the trucks stop running and the gas gets so expensive that the trucks can't afford it anymore, and then you'll be stuck, especially if you're in the city and you don't have your own garden, without any food. You really will. So you need a few. One tenth of an ounce, I would say, of gold is good to have, as many of those as you can afford. And you certainly need water, and you need food. So I had already put up some spinach and some other stuff, like canned spaghetti and canned ravioli and stuff. I make a wonderful dish out of it, and I'm on a diet, so you can trust what I tell you to eat. I won't ever do anything that makes you fat. But if you take a half a can of spinach and a half a can of beefaroni, that has about 170 calories, and you get two vegetables. You get points for two vegetables, and you're supposed to be eating five vegetables a day. So I'm stocking up my larder with vegetables. The big problem is vegetables. If you can possibly grow your own lettuce. That's where I'm down to. I've got everything under control except the lettuce. And you need fresh lettuce, I think, to be happy. So I wish I could figure out a way to make a little garden here on my balcony in the condo so I could grow fresh lettuce, but so far I haven't been able to do it. But if you have a garden, do grow lettuce. This is a beautiful perishable that you won't be able to get when the trucks shut down and all of the food disappears from the market. Getting back to this E. coli pervading the harvest area here in California, I think it's sabotage, because the Mexicans have made it very clear that they intend to take over our land, our country. They're getting very feisty and violent. I've been to the marches where Jim Gilchrist goes. He's the big Minuteman guy down here in California. And I see them. You don't see them, because unless you go to these marches, you don't see that the Mexicans come out with their communist banners. And I'm talking about the real red arm and sickle, the red hammer and sickle right on the black flag. And they carry them beside us and yell horrible names at us, and the women act like whores to the white men when they're marching. They really show their evil side, which you don't get to see if you're stuck on normal media. They never show you that. So these people are extremely angry, and they've been definitely frothed up to take over our country, and I honestly believe that the Mexicans are being instructed by their communist masters to defecate in our field. Why not? What a wonderful way to shut us down. So they have found E. coli bacteria in our harvest areas here in California, and they've taken spinach off the market. And the reason I'm suspicious of this article in the LA Times, which very clearly proves to you that this E. coli bacteria is coming from the cows, it's not coming from human beings, but that is not borne out by research. It does come also from human beings, and after all, the cows have been grazing upstream from the harvest field for about 300 or 400 years, and we've never had E. coli bacteria in the watershed before. So that makes me suspicious that I think that this is a human tampering with our garden supply. And another reason that I tend to think this is that this happened to us once before. During, I think it was about 10 years ago, I bought grapes and I got diarrhea. Now, that doesn't mean anything, does it? Of course not. I'm not going to stand on such flimsy evidence as that. But it's very unusual for me, and I did notice it. And then the news people came on the air, and they said, blah, blah, blah about immigrants. Immigrants doing this. Immigrants saying this. Oh, and by the way, there is nothing wrong with your grapes. The girl did it. You know, girls, sometimes girls will stick their neck out where guys won't. The girl newscaster said, and I want to say that I see right here that there's nothing wrong with our grapes. So everybody that had had grapes and had gotten dysentery from them knew that she was saying, you might think about those grapes that you ate, and then you got diarrhea because something about immigrants. So that's what we have in our fields right now. We've got a lot of Mexicans, and we've got fecal material coming through our food supply. Now, we are tightening rules for sex offenders, which frankly I'm against. I think that the men may disagree with me, but it always worries me when civilizations start focusing on sex crimes and raising the punishment for sex crimes because of the emotional nature of the crime and the almost impossible to prove these crimes. Of course, I think that a sex crime is a terrible crime, but I'm not sure that I want to elevate it above the crime of assault, which should get a very stiff sentence. Because when you start talking to people about sex, they get very crazy, and they start acting like in the old days, 1,000 years ago, where we would test if a person was a witch or not by putting weights on their feet and throwing them into the lake. These are just people that the society didn't like. And they'd come up and say, I think you're a witch. And then the woman would say, I'm not a witch. And they'd say, well, you have to prove it to us. If you have witch powers, we will know, because when we put weights on your feet and you sink to the bottom of the lake, you will be able to get free, because that's what witches can do. You have superpowers. That's what we think. And if you don't rise up from the lake, lucky you, you get to go to heaven because you were not a witch. So I think from that story you could get some idea about how emotional the justice system gets and how untrustworthy it is. For example, there was one case where it was a test case where they put an innocent man, and they did this several times, in the position of the defendant, in the seat of the defendant, and I think maybe they made him wear jail clothes, I'm not sure. But anyway, they dressed him up like a criminal and had him sit in the defense seat. And they were able to prove that with no evidence, and even when the guy was totally guilty, the average juror just got a visceral emotional reaction against the defendant and voted to find him guilty. And then, as I told you, in the old days, they used to put weights on the feet of witches and throw them in the well. So I think in some primitive societies, they even throw lots to decide if you're guilty or not. And the real thing that's going on here is that society creates these methods for getting rid of its unpopular people. So it concerns me when we start targeting sex offenders with so much emotionalism, because you know who's going to be accused of being a sex offender. It's always the white man and woman, always. Anytime Morris sees from Southern Poverty Law Center wants to get a white person, they concoct a crime, a sex crime against him, call him a pedophile, a child molester, and that's the way of marginalizing his voice and discrediting him. So we need to think very carefully about being fair with these laws and not creating a lot of emotion around this law or that law. For example, the hate speech laws are completely crazy. How come in the United States of America we are punishing people for feelings, which you can't help? That's what makes you human, is the fact that you have feelings. And if you hate someone, there's nothing wrong with that, and there shouldn't be. Hate should not be outlawed. That's why I have never believed that Jesus commanded us to love one another as he loved us, or that we should love our enemies. I believe he said things like that because, of course, that's what he would want for us. But I doubt very much that he said, if you don't love one another as I have loved you, I'm going to burn you at the stake. And that's how people are interpreting Jesus' words, that if you hate, you should be punished for the very emotion that makes you human, because the capacity to hate is a heartfelt reaction to a situation or a person, as is the reaction of love. So my concern is that when we start litigating against or legislating against hate, we are stopping the heart from feeling its own emotion. And like the hand that has to be able to open and close in order to be useful, if we put the heart in one position and keep it there, it loses all of its flexibility and all of its real function, which is to let the man know if he's in a good place or not. We want to be free to love, and we want to be free to hate. And of course, everyone knows the biblical passage where David says to God, I have hated your enemies with a perfect hatred, therefore, Lord, bless me, that we are supposed to have compassion to hate. But the hate crime, say, and my brother, the cowardly racist, thinks that people are right when they say, let's make it a law against hate because everybody should love. That's not a good idea. So we have to get rid of these hate crimes. I am even concerned when I see a black man getting convicted of a hate crime simply because I don't want anything I say to be construed that I think people should be punished for their emotions. Although, of course, we have to fight these fights, and I'm glad that we went to Kingston and pointed out that this was definitely a hate crime when that black teenager, who was over 200 pounds, pounded on little Robbie Tedrick and altered his vision permanently, calling him names. This was a hate crime, if there is such a thing as a hate crime, and so it was good that we went there and drew attention to the fact that the hate crimes are inequitably enforced. But really, we don't want to hate crime. What we really want is to go back to what our founding fathers had envisioned for us, which was the right to feel and speak exactly as we wanted to, because we have the right to free speech, and we have the right to our feelings. If we are going to commit a crime against someone we hate, naturally, that's a crime. The crime should stand on its own. If you beat somebody up, you should have to pay the price for beating somebody up, not for the fact that you hate them. So that's what very, very few religious people understand, that because they think that, well, if Jesus told us that we should love everyone, then let's put everyone in jail that ever hates us, and that's going to be, God will bless us for that. By the way, how do you feel about what's going on in the Middle East? Wasn't it nice that Chavez got before the United Nations had called Bush the devil? And indeed he is the devil, isn't he? If there is such a thing, which I don't really believe in the devil, but if anybody is the devil, it's Bush. Here he comes and tells people that God is speaking to him and telling him to kill 1.5 billion Arabs because they don't accept Jesus, and religious people are falling for it. How can they imagine that it is God's will for us to take depleted uranium and spread it all over the Middle East, killing and deforming millions and possibly 1.5 billion people? But there are people who believe that, and they're interpreting it from the Bible. They're finding passages that say that that in the end, Jesus will come with a mighty sword. Well, I don't believe that to be true. I've read the Bible at least twice, and I've studied Jesus carefully, and it doesn't look to me like this is a man who's so primitive that he would solve problems with a sword. I think that our problems with the Middle East could easily be worked out diplomatically. And I'm ashamed of my country because even in Gulf War I, where we were supposed to have a diplomatic resolution, they showed us right on the television that the Iraqi diplomats came and were polite and sat down to negotiate. And the Americans were violent jocks who snubbed the Iraqi diplomats and were rude to them and wouldn't let them finish their sentences. So we have never given Iraq a chance to even talk over the negotiating table. We purposely send in brutal people to make it impossible for the Iraqis to negotiate, and then we say they have failed to negotiate, and we bomb them. This is not what Jesus taught us. If you will read your Bible with a good teacher, you will learn that Jesus teaches us how to be better diplomats, because being the master race, the superior race, we have at our command talents that the non-whites don't have, talents of persuasion, talents of logic. What a stupid thing to think that the intellectual race, the white race, that has the capacity for thinking clearly and solving problems using logic, which the other races are not gifted to have, that we would fall to the level of the beast and say we're going to solve our problems with a sword, because that's what it says that Jesus wants us to do. Well, I'm not saying there's no place for force. I myself am certainly studying self-defense and going to be prepared for any attack that comes my way. I totally believe in self-defense, but this offensive war is a travesty, and any Christian who sees the horrors that we're inflicting on our fellow man should feel very sad, as I do, that for some reason we've lost control of our government, and our government is acting on our behalf in a way that will surely condemn us to hell, because this is no way for Christians to act. And that was the point Chavez was making when he got up yesterday at the United Nations and said, Bush is the devil. And this podium that I'm speaking from reeks with sulfur. And that is exactly what Bush is doing. He's spreading sulfur all over the world, his hideous, demonic product, which runs the world, and which we have to stop being a society that gets its money from the taxpayers in order to pay useless wars that don't even benefit our country. We could have bought the oil that Saddam Hussein had at market value. We're not a poor country. We can afford to pay market value. And if we can't, then we have to go without. That's what honest people do. They pay their way. They don't turn into pirates and steal and rape and pillage in order to get things. What Christian hasn't faced the fact that they had to do without something, and they took on that trial, they got through it because they did not want to steal or murder someone. So the idea that our country has become this pirate in order to benefit us is just horrifying to me. And there are good people, good Christian people, who are telling me, well, these Iraqis, these Muslims are bad people, and we have to kill all of them and turn the desert into a glass desert. How is it that people get to this point with their thinking just based on looking at the television? Of course, I haven't looked at the television because I got rid of mine about 3 months ago, I'm happy to say, and I've been a little bit more relaxed ever since. But I can't believe that people would allow themselves to get brainwashed to the point where they would condone their country going against innocent people and killing them because there's something in the scripture that can be twisted to make them believe that this is God's unfathomable will. And then when you realize what the Israelis have done to the Palestinians in terms of stealing 85% of their land, when we gave them 50% of it for fun and for free, and the Palestinians were happy to let them come in and have a homeland, these poor Jews who had been persecuted so horribly by evil Hitler and his crew. Really, they were happy to see them. They were going to move over and let them share the land. There was plenty of land. But on the very first day in 1947, the Jews came in with American military weapons, I'm sure, and weapons that they had procured from other places, and they started a campaign of murder and pillage and rape and terror that drove 750,000 Palestinians out of the Israeli section of the partition plan. Israel was not supposed to do that. The partition plan was predicated on the idea that they would allow the resident Palestinians to continue living in their homes, in their villages, and that they would not encroach the Palestinian side of the partition plan, which was approximately 50% of that area that the partition plan designated. But what happened instead was that the Jews terrorized 750,000 Palestinians and drove them off the Israeli side of the partition plan, and in a series of wars, they've been using American weapons to steal more and more land from the Palestinians, so that now the Palestinians are left with barely 12% of what they originally had, and a lot of them are in concentration camps, and they have been there for three generations. So how can we justify supporting Israel knowing this? Maybe we could support...
Thank you for listening tonight, ladies and gentlemen, to the evening edition of The Holocaust.